ADHD is a term that has become quite commonly used to describe somebody who tends to be very energetic or active, but this kind of description simplifies the nature of the actual disorder behind the acronym that is Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. There's more to ADHD than just hyperactivity, and in turn this means that there's more to consider when trying to treat the disorder. To get a clearer picture about ADHD, I have with me on the line Dr. Emma Siberes, a clinical psychologist and senior lecturer at Deakin University. Welcome to the show and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, to start off, I was wondering if you could please provide us with just a general overview of what ADHD is.
Yeah, so ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And children with ADHD have significant difficulty with inattention, hyperactivity and impulsivity. But in order to be diagnosed with ADHD, the symptoms of ADHD need to be present most of the time and they need to occur in multiple settings. So they need to be seen at both home and at school. And importantly, in order to be diagnosed, the symptoms need to be causing significant impact on daily functioning. So they need to be making academic and social functioning very difficult. And ADHD commonly occurs alongside other conditions. So up to 70% of children with ADHD will have one or more conditions that is associated, like an anxiety disorder or behavioural difficulties or sleep difficulties.
How widespread is ADHD amongst children and adults in the general population?
Recent population data from Australia suggests that ADHD affects about 7% of Australian children and adolescents. And at the population level, this equates to about 300,000 Australian children and adolescents. It's now well accepted that around two-thirds of children with ADHD will go on to continue to have ADHD as adults.
That is quite a large number of the population here. What is said to cause this kind of disorder?
There's no one cause for ADHD, but the best evidence to date suggests that it's caused by a combination of genetic and environmental factors. So it's well accepted that ADHD runs in families. Therefore, if a child is more likely to have ADHD if one or more of their parents has a history of symptoms. And the environmental factors that have been associated include exposure to toxins during pregnancy, like tobacco or alcohol, at high levels, and children born premature or with low birth weight are at a higher risk of ADHD. And there's also been a number of brain imaging studies that have shown differences in the brains of children with ADHD compared to those without ADHD.
Now, people have different perceptions about what exactly ADHD is, but what would you say is one of the most widespread misconceptions about the disorder?
I think a common misconception is that ADHD is a new condition. However, ADHD as we know it today was actually first described in the late 1700s, so it isn't new at all, but it's just had different names throughout history. So ADHD was actually referred to as minimal brain dysfunction in the early 1900s, and it wasn't until 1980 that the term attention deficit disorder was first used. I think another common misconception is that there's a concern about overdiagnosis. And although 7% of Australian children technically meet the criteria for ADHD, only about 3% have been diagnosed. So this really demonstrates that in Australia, we don't have a systematic problem with overdiagnosis.
I hadn't known that about the historical perspective. That was quite interesting.
Yeah, look, when I first got into ADHD, I found it really interesting too because I was, you know, was new to it and didn't know much. And what I did know was from the media, and often it is painted as a new condition now. But you can really go back and see the exact same descriptions as far back as the 1700s in history, which was really interesting.
A lot of us, like you said, we do get our information from the media. One of the most common symptoms, I would say, of ADHD that we tend to know about is, of course, the hyperactivity part. But there are some other main symptoms to look out for. So what are some of these main symptoms?
Yeah, so I guess, so hyperactivity is one of them. And I guess the symptoms that go along with ADHD are really symptoms around difficulties paying attention. So difficulties being able to attend to tasks, getting easily distracted, not being able to follow through on instructions, and also impulsive type behaviours too. So, you know, not being able to wait, not being able to hold back in a conversation and interrupt quite a lot. And as I said before, a lot of us will experience some of these symptoms sometimes. So we've all had difficulties in one or more of these areas. But with ADHD, we're looking at these symptoms occurring most of the time, and really making it difficult to learn in particular. And I guess the other kinds of symptoms that you can see are kind of difficulties managing emotions, so kind of more having emotional outbursts and finding it difficult to settle down in different situations. So again, these kinds of symptoms, when they're experienced at a high level, especially in the classroom, can have a big impact for not only the children, but also for the teachers and the children around them in the classroom.
So I guess what we're looking for is a long period of time of displaying these kinds of symptoms.
Yes.
Would you say that there's a big difference in the way that ADHD tends to affect adults compared to children?
Yeah, so although we do know that ADHD tends to be persistent into adulthood, we do tend to see a decline in the more hyperactive symptoms, but more persistence in those difficulty concentrating and those the parts of attention that are involved in ADHD. And also the kind of consequences of ADHD are different in adulthood. So there's been research showing that having these difficulties with inattention and not being able to pay attention, they can cause difficulties in occupational functioning. So you can imagine it can make it difficult to do your job, especially if you're at a desk type job. It can also make social relationships more strained. So there's research looking at rates of relationship breakdowns and divorce for adults with ADHD, and they're increased. It can also be associated with riskier driving behaviour, so more likely to get speeding fines and have accidents. And then in a very small percentage of cases, it can involve increased risk of contact with the criminal system. So the symptoms continue to be present, but the implications of them are quite different in adulthood.
After hearing some of this information, some people might be thinking that they might have ADHD, or they might know somebody who has the disorder. What should they do if they suspect that they have ADHD?
Yeah, the best way to seek a further assessment for ADHD is to first visit your GP, so your general practitioner, and they can provide a referral to an appropriate person to do a thorough assessment. In children, this might include a paediatrician with expertise in ADHD or a psychologist. And in adults, that might include a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And that can mean that person can then go through a thorough history and do a thorough assessment of how long these symptoms have been occurring, how much of an impact they cause on daily life, you know, look for evidence that they're occurring across multiple settings and so on, and then develop an appropriate treatment plan.
And mentioning that treatment plan, how is ADHD usually treated or managed?
Yeah, the most well-accepted approach to treatment for ADHD is a combination of medication and behavioural interventions. And the most common medications prescribed are stimulant medications. And there's been a lot of research looking at this, and they have been shown to reduce the main symptoms of ADHD. So improve inattention, the hyperactivity and impulsive behaviours that we see. But behavioural interventions might be tried first before medication to see whether these can have an influence. And even if medication is prescribed, behavioural treatment should occur. And these kinds of treatments involve mainly helping parents to manage the difficult behaviours that they're experiencing in the home setting, but also working with teachers to help create an optimal learning environment for children with ADHD. So best practice is a combination of medication and behavioural interventions.
And to kind of wrap up for today, something that I found quite interesting based on your research was that you identified that targeting sleep and anxiety problems in children with ADHD may improve their symptoms and outcomes. Now, what has led you to this conclusion in your research?
Yeah, so our research has shown that both sleep and anxiety are very elevated in children with ADHD, so affecting about 60 to 70%. And also sleep and anxiety make functioning worse for children with ADHD. So they make the symptoms more severe, they make learning more difficult, and they make quality of life poor. aura. So we wondered whether treating the sleep and anxiety problems in children with ADHD could be one way of improving outcomes. And we've conducted a very large trial looking at sleep problems, and we found in 244 children with ADHD that if you targeted the sleep problems using behavioural strategies, that you not only saw an improvement in sleep, but that ADHD symptoms improved. We found improvements in working memory, quality of life, and classroom functioning. So we were really excited by these findings, and we're currently training up paediatricians and psychologists in the first stage in Victoria and Queensland in delivering this intervention to their patients. And we've also done a very similar trial focused on anxiety and found very similar results. In particular, we found that if you target anxiety in children with ADHD, we see a real improvement in the inattention symptoms that are experienced. The anxiety trial that we ran was a very small trial to start off with, but now we're in the middle of a big trial which will have over 200 families to see whether or not we continue to see benefits when we're doing it at this large level in the population.
And with that, we have come to the end of the interview with Dr. Emma Siberes, a clinical psychologist and senior lecturer at Deakin University. Thank you for your time today, Emma.
Thank you very much for having me.